Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage. Remember, we con when you can't.
All right. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Mapping for Writers. And this is basically a 101 level cartography, not class, get together. We're going to give you some basic advice. We don't have a projector, so you're just going to have to visualize.
Which ultimately, if you're planning on mapping, you should develop as a skill, because before you can draw a map, you have to have in your brain what you want the map to look like.
Yeah.
So let's start. Practice that.
Yeah, let's start introducing ourselves. Mark, you got to go first last time, so.
Hi, I'm Linda Zayas Palmer. I am a developer at Paizo, and I work primarily with the Pathfinder Society scenarios.
Hi, I'm Crystal Frazier. I'm an Adventure Path developer at Paizo Publishing, and I'm a cartographer, illustrator, writer, editor, developer. So, in theory, I've got this covered.
And I'm Mark Moreland. I develop the back matter of the Adventure Paths currently. In the past, I've developed a lot of adventures that involved maps, including Pathfinder Society for a few years, as well as Pathfinder modules for a number of years. So I've certainly done my share of mapping and map development.
So, yeah, we're basically here to make sure that your map turnovers that you're doing for your home game or that you're putting together to send to your developer along with your awesome adventure turnover are legible and things that we can work with and turn into a final published map.
So just to get a little bit of a sense of what we're getting started off here, by a show of hands, who here is interested in creating maps for publication?
Okay,
cool, about half.
Who's here just to make their home game maps a little stronger?
Okay.
All right, cool. So, yeah, I guess the best place we can start here is, I mean, mapping from the ground up is mostly a way to control the flow of adventure. Your map is, for all intents and purposes, a flowchart for your adventure and how you want your PCs to run through it. You can make a very linear map. Pardon.
While Crystal is dying, I will continue her thought.
Rimmer came back!
Yeah, so you can do a very linear map where one room has one exit, and that room has one exit, and that room has one exit, so that you know the players are going to encounter these rooms in this order. That can be very handy for distributing information in a specific order if you want players to get different clues and you want to ensure that they get them, you know, in alphabetical order instead of randomly. It's often seen as less fun for players because
choo-choo.
Yes, they call it a railroad because it goes in a straight line, you know? And some players don't mind that. A lot of them do, you know? They want to have some choice. So if you're not doing a linear map, you can do one that gives unlimited choice where there's countless paths through the dungeon. And then another way would be to do something that gives the illusion of choice, but is ultimately still providing information and encounters in an order that you still are largely controlling for narrative purposes.
Yeah, it's stating the obvious to say so, but your map is what puts walls on your encounters and lets you determine what order people encounter things in. I start all of my map sketches specifically as flowcharts because I want to figure out, what do they encounter? What's the big encounter first? And what are the choices they make? And that can tell me, like, is it one-way path? Are there branches? Are there specific tasks they have to do to spell out the branches? And then I will just turn my initial flowchart for my adventure into the first sketch and, like, here's the room and here's this room here and...
And when you're pulling together these encounters as a part of the map, one thing that's important to keep in mind is to have the map serve the way that you want the encounters to interact with each other. So if there are encounters that are in very close proximity in their rooms that are very close together
with no doors,
then and those creatures in both of those rooms are allies, you know, those are probably likely to combine. So you might want to move them a little farther apart, or put a hallway in there, or you know, it can be an interesting exercise in thinking about what kind of motivations the character, the NPCs might have to not help each other. Like, you know, this NPC is too lazy and wants these NPCs to take care of it, or assumes they can handle it, or wants to wait back and have the creatures in the first room fight while, like, the creature in the back room is standing there casting all the buff spells, and then the PCs have to decide, okay, are we going to go after that or not? So there's that in terms of the separation of encounters. And another thing, too, is the size of the spaces. So if you have sometimes you're going to want a big open space. For example, if you're having, like, size larger, size huge creatures, you're going to want to have a lot of maneuverability in there. In other cases, you're going to want to have the smaller spaces, those cramped hallways where you might not
have... You force the PCs into lightning bolt formation.
You force the PCs into a single file line. Maybe you have a
fireball-sized
door back there, and there's someone else who comes out and attacks whoever they chose to put in the back line, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's... I mean, we're just touching on basic design assumptions right now. We'll get into specifics later, but think about what your room size and shape tells your players. Large rooms tend to either mean you're going to face a large opponent, or it's going to encourage ranged combat, because why would I run all the way over there and get stabbed by those lions that don't have ranged attacks when I can break out my bow or cast lightning bolt or things like that? Whereas if you pop out into a winding tunnel that intersects back on itself a couple of times, I mean, that is perfectly suited for melee combat and getting penned in or
and
getting
flanked
mm-hmm.
and rogues and stuff like that, sneaking and stealth.
Yeah, so if you're putting, if you've got sneaky monsters like kobolds, they're not going to hang out in a big open space. If you've got,
there's nowhere to hide.
Yeah,
and if you've got an ogre, he's not going to squash himself into a 10-foot by 10-foot room and just wait for somebody to stand in the hallway and jab him in the thigh.
Yeah, so going back to Crystal talking about the flowchart, one thing that I do is I'll use index cards, and on each one I'll write what monster or encounter I want in the room, any information that I want the PCs to be able to get, whether it's through finding, you know, some letter under a rock, or, you know, some MacGuffin in a dead adventurer's backpack or whatever. Mm-hmm. As well as, monster information, and then any, like, hazards or specific elements of the room that I want to play into the encounter. You know, if I want the floor to be collapsing, if a player stays in the same square for more than two rounds or something like that, then I'm going to write that on that card. And then I can rearrange the order that those cards are and set, you know, I can have the one entry chamber that's got the three doors off of it, and then I set next to it the three options, and you can sort of then say, oh, you know what, this encounter is too similar to the one it's next to. Well, with that card, it's very easy just to move it somewhere else, and you could sort of almost lay out the shape of your room. If you're writing for publication, the shape of your map is very important, because it has to go on a page, and pages are rectangles. And that means that if you're doing a full page map that you don't want people to have to turn, your map needs to be taller than it is wide. And in general, you want your map to use as much of your available space as possible, because we pay the same amount to a cartographer if it's got three rooms in an L shape and a bunch of empty space than we do if it has a dozen rooms and goes corner to corner on that page.
Speaking as a cartographer, though, three rooms in an L space and the rest empty is just great to draw.
yeah, exactly. It's like ka-ching.
And then I go play Mass Effect.
Right. And if you're doing a half-page map, and your developer or the person assigning you the work should tell you ahead of time what your map allotment is, then you want it to be wider than it is tall, because that's how it's going to be set up on the page. And with people reading so many things on PDF these days, or simply having the book and wanting to read the text and look at the map, having a map or a book that you need to turn on its side in order to see at the right angle can be disruptive to getting that information quickly at the gaming table.
Yeah. Another thing with the map and drawing it out and using it too is, like, for a lot of our maps, we say, okay, north is up. And generally, like, you know, some things are going to be drawn funny and skewed and things like that because it's important to have interesting shapes. But whenever you have those more boxy rooms and stuff like that, making them line up with the grid is... GMs are going to like that a lot more.
Yeah.
And players are going to like it because they're not going to have to count diagonal movement to walk through a square room.
Yeah. Just from a sketching it out standpoint, using graph paper, even if you're not strictly using a 5-foot grid, mm-hmm. helps you keep your scale the same across the whole map. I particularly like it for overland maps, even though there's no grid on those, because then I can keep in mind, like, 1/4-inch square is about the size of, let's say, 3 houses, so I know how many houses fit into my town. But yeah, we've been talking a lot about, like, maps as... map concepting as design for your adventure. There's also the angle of making your maps believable as places humans or elves, places things live.
Or build.
Mm-hmm. And the important things to remember there, God, especially, is that humans are lazy. So always think about the easiest line to move through your map, because that's how people will build it, and that's how your players will use it. Unless there is something blocking them. So if you're
Or
designing...
there's something that they need that's a different direction.
Yeah. So if you're designing a house, then there is going to be a clear path between the front door and the kitchen, and likely the front door and bedrooms. If you're designing a town, the things people need are water and food. So they will put their towns where there is water and food. So towns almost always spring up on springs or along rivers or lakesides or coastlines. So think about that.
Desert cities are rare, mm-hmm. because there's no water and there's nothing to hunt to eat. And it's hard to grow your food. I mean, that's why if you look at maps of the Western United States, the cities are much further apart because resources are more scarce. So when you're mapping a nation or a region, keep in mind that, you know, most of your cities, at least the large settlements, are likely to be on rivers or lakes or the coast. And then they'll get smaller or more scattered as you move from there.
Yeah. Or
yeah. We have a question.
Also, in a pre-industrial setting, rivers are handy because they provide a way to transport more goods than you can fit in an ox cart.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, trade routes are also important to look at. Because in addition to goods, you have ideas. You can have armies. You can have all sorts of things that use rivers or lakes or oceans in order to engage with other characters.
Yeah, and like the idea of ease of flow can help you with. Just as something as simple as, I'm designing an abandoned mine, so people start mining, they carve into the rock, and they might follow the veins and scoop all around, and your mine might start here and just wind around until it's here. Well, the miners who have to go in every single day aren't going to walk in here and traipse the half mile to get here.
They're going to dig a new tunnel.
Yeah, they're going to tunnel that goes sideways, and it might not connect directly to the end.
Right.
And one way to help see, like, so what are these more intuitive ways that people use is to draw inspiration from real-world architecture to look up, okay, what do mines look like? What do temples look like and things like that? And you can use that, too, to help give your campaign a feel, like, that it, you know, it feels kind of like Rome, for example. You might be able to look up examples of Roman architecture and use that, and that's a way to start bringing that into your game.
For your home games, steal liberally.
Yes.
There are so many maps you can find that are real-world floor plans that come from a multitude of online mapping forums.
Or public records.
Public records.
Like, if, like there, you can get floor plans of almost all of, like, the federal buildings in Washington, D.C. I mean, they're 200 years old, and they were built, you know, they're public buildings. So you can get rough floor plans. I mean, not specific, like, vents and things, because terrorists. But
that's how I'm going to steal the Constitution.
Yes, yes.
You saw the mics on.
It's written on the back of the Constitution that Nicolas Cage is in.
No, you see, they need to know I'm coming, otherwise it's not a challenge.
So you can get stuff at public records, or if you're, you know, like, if it's a public space, a lot of times places have maps. Like, if it's a shopping mall, like, say you're doing a zombie apocalypse game, and you want to have it take place in a mall, which is a completely original idea. No one's ever done that.
You should do that.
Yeah. They call it Day of the Zombie.
Oh.
Yeah.
What about Post Sunrise of the Dead?
Yes, yes. In any case, go to your local mall, and, like, they probably have a brochure or at the very least a You Are Here map. Like, take a picture of that. Like, that's what a mall looks like.
That's your game.
There you go. Put that on top of a grid and you're set.
Stealing saves so much time.
Unless you're writing for publication, in which case most of those maps are copywritten or, you know, or clearly, like, oh, this is the White House. Like, what?
Yeah,
like why is the White House in Tal'Dor? Like,
this is the Parthenon.
What? Exactly.
Why am I having a fight in the Parthenon?
Yeah, I mean, if people are familiar with the map, not only does it break verisimilitude because people are like, that's you know, clearly this other thing, but also someone who's familiar with the layout of that, I mean, you do get players who will say, oh, I took the White House tour. I know that if I turn right here, that's going to take me to the Rose, you know, the Rose Garden or whatever. And that's no fun.
Yeah, that's saying there's no one saying you can't take the White House map, turn or flip it upside down, add some extra rooms, block off some hallways, and call that an original map.
Now every map we get for the next 2 years is just going to be the White House.
Don't send us maps of the White House. We've already used that to death. Like, basically, every map in Kingmaker was just the White House in varying states of decay.
Yes.
Yeah, you don't believe me. Go home. Look it up.
We had a question over here.
I was just curious, in terms of, outside of coming up with your outlines and stuff, do you usually write to a set piece that you've already designed, or do you start with your writing and then come up with your map to kind of function within that writing?
Typically bounce back and forth. I usually come up with, unless I've got just a gonzo idea for a map, like I did with Iron Gods, I just start off with, these are the kinds of encounters that I want, and this is, I think, the order I kind of want them in, but I don't know yet, and then I start sketching out a map idea from that rough flow, and then that flow will give me new ideas of, like, well, what if I put a big atrium here to keep them all separated, but I don't want players just running back and forth through the atrium, so it's got, like, killer vines hanging from the ceiling, and the floor collapses every time they walk across it, so the more they use it, the more they have to rely on swinging through flesh-eating vines, and that feeds back into the writing, and...
Yeah, I find it's the same for me, bouncing back and forth. I like to think about what are the main encounters and things I want to have happen here. So that's not how exactly does everything work together, but it's like, okay, yeah, you know, we've got the hobgoblin boss who's going to be in here somewhere, or it's the kobold boss, and I know I want to have some like, you know, boulder rolling trap at some place or whatever. But then you can use that and then work back and forth and have it continue to build the inspiration for that.
What if the kobolds had giant pill bugs instead of boulders?
Sold.
I do very similar. I mean, I think there are times that if I'm doing a dungeon crawl through a mine where the encounters, where there's less of a story and more of a, like, oh, there's this mine here, you can explore it, then I'm more likely just to draw a cool map of a mine and then populate it with stuff. But if I'm doing, you know, like the enemy's castle that you have to infiltrate, and they have specific defenses that are built strategically, I'm going to figure out what those are and then place them on the map in a way that makes sense for the circumstances and situation. So the more planned the actual map would be in the real world, the more effort I'm going to put into what's in the map before I draw it. In the same way that you don't design a house by just going, you know, oh, let's, you know, well, I'm just going to draw a map and then we'll decide later which one's the kitchen. You know, like you realize you need bathrooms and kitchens and bedrooms and, you know, and then you place them where it's logical. But
I find
if it's
bathrooms to be entirely optional.
Well, they certainly are on adventuring maps. But if you're doing a cave, for example, that's being formed by the flow of water through cracks in rock, and it doesn't care what shape it ends up. So with that, it can just be like, put on, you know, something on TV and just sit there and go. And then when you're done, you say, does that look like a map that I could put? No, it doesn't. Okay, I'll start over.
Spill
and we'll watch another episode, you know, and like just... Yeah.
Or like, I like this piece of it, but not this piece. Okay, erase the piece I don't like, and then
right.
It can be useful to have, like, you know, but it's interesting, obviously, to have, like, you know, some scratch maps where you draw some pieces and then gradually bring it together. It's
mm-hmm.
fun.
Mm-hmm.
Like.
So we've talked a lot about primarily tactical scale maps. One of the largest challenges that we as developers have, and that we have because it's a challenge for our authors, are drawing cities and drawing overland maps. Because it can be very easy to... The number of times I've gotten an overland map turnover that is, like, blank with, like, blob of forest, line of river.
Blob of desert.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's just like, okay, technically, yes, this is a map of this stuff, but it's super boring. You know, it... That can really be a challenge. So one thing to keep in mind with those are, like Crystal said, things are going to have water, but also like towns or settlements. Think of how many people live in your town, and think of how much space that would take up. Like, sure, in the modern day, we can either have very very dense places because we can build 50-story buildings, which you can't really do in a fantasy setting. I mean, I guess you could with magic, but it's not common. Even in Absalom, we don't have buildings that tall.
Illusion shattered.
Yes. Just disbelieve. Just don't disbelieve. And then, yes. You know, so keep in mind population density, that if you're doing a town of 100,000, there's going to be a lot of buildings. Because in order to fit that many people, you're just going to need to cram them in, or your map is going to be huge. But also keep in mind that in medieval times, people still had pretty dense... Mm-hmm. Plus, because people didn't have a lot of space. No one had a three-bedroom house. Like, you lived in a two-room building, and that was it. Or
You lived in
the top floor. Yeah, you
lived closet.
Yeah, exactly. You lived in the top floor of something else, and some of that depends on the economy of the city that you're doing too. If it's a very merchant friendly place where everyone lives on the top floor of their shop, it's going to be very different than somewhere that's you know, like a industrial city where their whole thing is crafting armor and siege weapons, where you're going to have a lot of people living in tenement style things with very large industrial buildings like factories that are just going to dwarf the size of the houses. So you'll have a lot of very small, crowded districts where the workers live, and then larger open spaces where they work, or where if it's a military city, you're going to have very regimented
wide streets,
because you need to get horses and carts and marching armies down them, and you're likely to have a lot of right angles. If it's a city that needs to be defended, you're likely to have a lot of circles, which people hate. But for a city map, you're likely already drawing things that are different, that aren't on a grid anyway, because you're building it to the landscape. One of the best tips that I learned from Adam Daigle, who does incredible city maps, is to start with just the geography. So you draw the shape of the bay, and then you draw very, very large scale topographical elements. So if there's a hill, or say there are 7 hills in your city, you know, and you want to people are naturally going to build important things on the tops of those hills.
Yeah, you put your citadel on top of a hill because it's hard to get an army up a hill.
Right.
By the time you're up there, you don't want to sack a citadel.
Yeah, no, you just want to rest.
Yeah, you put mansions on the tops of hills for the same reason.
Yeah, well, and because they can see very far. You know, if you're doing a university or a watchtower, you put it high up. But you start with just that topography. And so you take your piece of paper, and then you outline the things that you're sure you want to be on the final map in, like, thick Sharpie. Scan that or take a high-res picture of it. Print that out. Or, yeah, make a photocopy of it and print that out and use that as your starting point for the next level, which is to show where your major roads are or where your city walls are. And now you've already got, in the same way that the walls are built on the hills and they curve to accommodate geographical features, that you've got the land, basically, that you're building. And so if you think of it as, you know, one of those video game, you know, like SimCity type things, you know, like first you have the shape of your land and then you build the roads. And once you've built the roads, then you put the houses next to the roads. And so you do that in a series of steps where you sketch out the city walls, and then once you're satisfied with that, you do Sharpie over the ones you want to make it to the next round, and then you use that as your baseline. And that way you're only ever working on drawing one layer of your map at a time. And if you decide, you know what, I don't like the way these roads look, you just go back and you make another photocopy of just the walls.
Yeah. And, I mean, always remember that, again, humans are kind of lazy. They will try to take the shortest route between two points. So if you have a city gate and a harbor that's important, there's probably going to be a more or less straight road between them.
And important things will be along that road.
Yes. Unless there's a hill right between them, because people hate going up hills.
So there's either a tunnel through the hill, or if it's dwarves, or they're...
You and your dwarf tunnels.
Hey. Don't be racist. Or else they're going to go around the hill. And because you've already drawn the shape of that hill, the steepness of those curves, you can look and see, like, is this small ridge enough that they're going to go around it, or are they just going to go over it? Are they able to go straight up it, or are they going to be going up, you know, like a 40% grade, or do they have to do switchback to get up this slope, you know? And that's how you can make really interesting cities where the players, by looking at the map, can get a sense of what the terrain looks like, what the environment looks like. If you're writing for publication and you turn over a map like that, we can usually give that map to both to a cartographer and come back with something really fun. But also, we can give that to an illustrator and say, we would like you to draw a landscape of this city from out in the middle of the harbor, looking at the city. And they can look at that map and get an idea of what, you know, where there's going to be hills. Like, oh, look, clearly the castle is at the top of the hill at the north end of the city, so I'm going to make that prominent in my framing of this picture. And so a lot of those, you know, gorgeous cityscapes that you'll see in some of our books are the direct result of having a good map for us to give to someone who draws landscapes.
And, yeah, I mean...
Oh. We have a question over here?
No, you guys were talking about graph paper and physically drawing it.
Honestly, whatever digital tools you have access to and are comfortable with. I've done a lot of mapping with Paint Tool Sci, which is a relatively inexpensive drawing app. I've done a ton of mapping in Photoshop, which makes it very easy to go from very simple shapes to very complicated shapes. I do a lot of urban mapping with Adobe Illustrator, because urban mapping, like Mark was getting into, is all about deciding the shapes of first your geography, then your terrain elevations, and then roads, and basically it's all about subdividing your shapes again and again and again to show how people flow through space.
But even as someone who's very proficient with digital graphics programs, you still do a lot of your mapping by hand.
Oh yeah, I do. I would say more than 50% of my mapping by hand, unless it's time to do a finished map for a commission or something like that. It's just, I don't know, easier for me. It's going to be different for everybody.
So for coastlines, where is the line between having a realistic coastline with different jagged bits and having a messy coastline that looks
a lot of that just comes down to an eye you develop looking at other maps.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Google Earth is your friend.
Yeah,
like if
just
you
steal from Google Earth, basically.
Yeah, I mean, if you,
I'm not saying steal.
I mean,
steal.
Because in the real world, coastlines are a function of elevation. You know, if you have somewhere where the elevation is very standard, and there's not a lot of hills large rock formations leading up to the water, you're going to have a fairly straight coastline, because that slope is just going to go right into the water. It's where you have, you know, mountains abutting the water that you get fjords that are very, you know, finger-like or narrow.
Yeah.
Or if you have...
If you have a hilly coastline like Seattle has, then you end up with a lot of islands.
Yes, and if you have, somewhere that's very rocky, then you might end up with something more like the coastline of Maine.
With the sudden drop-offs.
Yeah, exactly, where you're going to have some very deep, bays and things like that, that are determined by where the rocks just happen to stick out of the water. I would also think about what you want from a functional, game standpoint, that coastline to be. If you want it to be a place where smugglers have their hideouts and stuff, then you're going to want a lot of little hidden coves and jetties and things for them to navigate around that make it difficult for them to be pursued or discovered. If you want it to be a busy port where you have ships from all over coming and harboring, then you're going to want it to be, large, easily accessible, while still protected from, large waves.
And severe weather.
So you probably want it to be not just directly on the coast, but maybe in a bay that's got a peninsula protecting it or something. But a lot of really jagged stuff does not make for a good place to build a city with docks and stuff like that.
So,
think about how it would be used and look at the real world for how the coastlines work and where people chose to build cities and things.
Yep. And keep in mind how long people have been in an area, because people will reshape the geography.
Mm-hmm.
We are an industrious species, and even before we had modern engineering technology, we were diverting the flow of rivers, we were creating artificial land.
Terracing mountains.
Terracing mountains. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the older a city is, the more we will build out the harbor and dredge deeper channels to make it accessible for our needs.
Mm-hmm.
So your coastline...
Especially if you cast Moon Earth.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
It gets a lot more practical.
Or Wall of Stone. If you want to build a seawall to, have a more robust coastline, then
you
just...
a ninth level wizard.
Wall of Stone?
Yeah.
Oh, ninth level, yeah.
Ninth
no,
level
I thought... I was thinking ninth level...
Yeah.
Spell. I was like, that's not that high level.
Yeah.
Although it's really hard sending one kid from your village off to school until he's ninth level and bringing him back and just having him cast Wall of Stone to pay off the
He's like, guys,
loans.
I'm capable of so much more.
Just
like,
cast
no,
the spell.
No. It's better than being the kid who gets to stand there and stick his finger in the hole in the wall. That was a Hans Brinker joke for anyone who wasn't here.
You talked about, with the wilderness maps, avoiding, you know, blob of forest, blob of desert, river. So what do you look for to make those more interesting when you don't have a town or city?
A lot of that comes down to just understanding geography and how water flows, how weather flows.
If it's a volcanic region, for example, or, you know, was this area created by glacial movement?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, like many things, is a huge rabbit hole you can go down, and sometimes you
it's
go down it and you find out, oh, this map actually should look very boring because, you know, it is, you know, this used to be a seabed. You know, like, the Midwest is very flat because it used to be the bottom of an ocean, you know?
Well, then the glaciers dragged across
glaciers did stuff with it, you know, and you've got, yeah. So some of that, you just look online and see what it is. One secret that I've used, is especially in home games, is literally take a map from a real place and flip it upside down. And it looks, I mean, people won't, we are conditioned to think of north as up and of things as certain shapes because we continually look at maps from that perspective. So take something that's not, you know...
The lighthouse.
Yes, yeah. Or, you know, a map from a different part of the world. You know, like, look up Chinese national parks. And... My players certainly don't know what the national parks in Hunan province look like. So I can...
Who doesn't know them? Or who doesn't know them?
Not everyone is as smart as you. And, you know, use that as your baseline. Another trick is just to draw the basic blobs that you want and then put other stuff in the way so that people can't just travel from one to another. Oh, there's a ravine here. Or, you know what, there's a bridge over this river, but it collapsed. Or, you know, there was a forest fire here, and so there's weird, like, pockets where the trees are all very, very young. And so we've got two shades of green in my blob of a forest that gives a story to it and life to it and something for the... a reason for that map of that blob to be there. If it's just a blob, we don't really need to draw a map because you can just say somewhere in the forest there is a ruin. It doesn't really matter where it is because the players are, there's nothing distinctive that they're going through to get there. So that's one way to avoid that.
Came across Pro Fantasy with this campaign cartographer, they have some pretty good tutorials on their YouTube channel on basic map design and how, where, why you want base mountains a certain way, why rivers go a certain way, and building up the map, the layers of the map that way. It's a pretty decent 101, even if you don't use the tool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, like, one...
Oh, the tool itself is, or tutorials themselves are pretty handy. If you're working professionally, I would be cautious with Campaign Cartographer, and this is something we see every year in RPG Superstar. It's very easy to make a map that's super pretty in Campaign Cartographer that makes no sense.
Yeah.
It's a very pretty single room, or very pretty house with a basement.
Yeah.
And it's... If for your home games, if that's all you need, then Campaign Cartographer is a great tool. If you're working professionally, then it's a very easy trap to fall into of, I've made my map pretty, but it's not a useful adventure
guide. And despite how pretty it is, we still have to send it to a cartographer who's going to redraw it and put their own textures and things on it because we do not own the rights to publish the textures that and the, you know...
Art
assets, the furniture and barrels and things that you get from Campaign Cartographer. So, yeah, but the tutorials are great. There's also a lot of tutorials about There's like Reddit groups about world building and things like that where people talk, where other people have already gone and done the research about the way that lakes form. Mm-hmm. And there you'll learn that lakes do not have two outflows. They may have two things flowing into a lake, but they tend to not have multiple things flowing out of them.
Yeah, once you have one lowest point water can exit through,
it goes that way.
That goes that way.
Yeah.
It doesn't get higher to find a second.
Yeah.
Question over
here? Yeah, I was going to build off the glacier thing, actually. One thing I found interesting is my stepfather's related to geography stuff, and I lived in eastern Washington for a little bit. So going to local geography like seminars, the guy went on and on about the history of eastern Washington. I found it really boring, but the part that was fascinating is he showed pictures of what eastern Washington used to look like.
Did you have a question?
Like now. I was going to say, with glaciers, you can look at like the Google Earth, because like eastern Washington looks like big claw marks
mm-hmm.
of glaciers.
Yeah.
And that kind of shows you, like, looking at the what it used to look like versus what it looks like now, kind of gives you an idea of that kind of transition.
Yeah, so that if you have a world where you want to say, you know, 10,000 years ago, there was a civilization that built here, and then glaciers came. Here's what the landscape looks like now. Definitely looking at places in the real world where they've done that will show you what type of geographical formations come from it.
Galarian hasn't really had an ice age in a very long time, have
magic.
Urisid.
Yeah, well, Urisid is... Yeah.
Well, all we had was dark.
Yeah, and magic to keep it warm. But, yeah, do you have
that's where all those fire spells came from.
Resources online for, like, information on, like, urban demographics in different cities in different eras. So if I want to say, okay, how big was a medieval Chinese city and how many people could it support?
Wikipedia.
Wikipedia is really good at that. And just Google. I mean, there are people who are... Any question you have, there is someone out there on the internet who's super into it and wants you to know how super into it they are.
Yeah, but the Wikipedia articles for a lot of historic cities will list their populations over a couple hundred years.
Yeah, like at 50-year increments, or basically however often they took censuses.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can find that, and it, depending how good records are, that you can look at maps that just, like, look at maps from every 100 or 200 years over the course of history from places, and you can see sort of how the cities change. You know, even if you look at modern cities, if you look at a map of Seattle from 1950, it is very different than a map of Seattle now. Like, the...
Sparse.
Yeah, yeah, you know. And so you're certainly going to get that in looking at cities over the course of hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm. Also... understand that it took a lot longer to travel back then.
Mm-hmm.
I live in the Snoqualmie Valley, which isn't terribly far away. It's about 30 miles.
From here, yeah.
But it's a valley, and you have to go over a steep hill just to get into Redmond. It's 20 minutes by car. That would have been an 8-hour mule trip.
Yeah.
100 years ago.
Because your mule would have to stop every, you know, 300 feet going up a, you know, a slope that's like this.
Yeah. My car has to stop every 300 feet.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I've found that it can be a trap trying to make my urban maps too accurate to population densities of the time. Like, Paris in the 1500s was incredibly densely populated.
Mm-hmm.
But as an adventure location, think about what you want your players to do in a city. If you want them to have a bunch of battles in the streets, like, don't make a lot of really narrow winding streets, because those are much harder for you to map on a tactical scale and harder for the PCs to navigate, you know. So I think there's a certain line between trying to be realistic in terms of sizes of buildings and number of buildings and the fact that it is a made-up world that needs to serve the function of being a, you know, map of a place people are supposed to have fun in.
Yeah. Plus, unless you're getting it printed up as a poster map, your final map's going to be printed that big, so there's only so much detail that's practical.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
yes.
A balancing act.
One of my favorite things in games and books is, like, when you get to, like, when like a big end reveal is somewhere that's like you're not expecting that to be. So do you have any suggestions for like kind of funneling players to something without them being aware that that's where they're headed?
You can actually find this done really well in a lot of video games. A lot of video games give you the illusion of choice, and then when you take the wrong choice, like, nothing necessarily bad happens to you, but maybe the tunnel collapses in front of you and you have to turn around and take the other of the two choices. You might basically follow what looks like a diverging path that if you go down a different route, there's an explosion and it collapses and you slide down to the other path. Or, I mean, let the characters choose, but give them not necessarily damaging consequences. You're not trying to punish them for making the wrong random choice, but set events up that look like, okay, this would have happened, or this is a consequence of my choice, and things have happened, but now we're going this way.
Yeah, I mean, one thing is if you're using, like, a pre-drawn map, like, a lot of GMs will take the time to draw their dungeon ahead of time because it's way faster. That can telegraph to the players where the final thing is going to be. In general, those take place in large rooms. So if your map is all, you know, weaving, but leaves this big chunk in the middle that's not filled in yet, or there's the big room in the middle that they can see on the map even though they're not there yet, then that can foreshadow where they're going to be. Consider either only, you know, drawing it on like 8.5 by 11 graph paper and setting them out room by room, so that players get, and taking them away when players have left a room, so that they don't get a sense of the overall shape of the dungeon. They're really just looking at where they are now, unless they're keeping their own map, which people do far less now than they did in first edition when that was the only way to get a map. Another way is to just, you know, and it's situational, but to have places that are only accessible via teleportation, via, you know, a secret door that you need to go to all these different places to open. So there's no clear, like, path straight to the throne room, but you need to go and get, like, all these different gems to put in the, you know, the statue, and then suddenly that sinks into the ground and you have this stairwell down to something, so that you're making the journey an adventure in itself, rather than projecting where it's going to be and having the players having the risk of them even casting a spell like find the path or something that just takes them right there.
And generally, if there's two ways to go, and one of them is a door, and one of them requires you to go out over like a pit of acid or something, people are gonna choose to try the door first. So, you know,
what players do you have?
Yeah,
seriously.
You don't get XP for opening a door.
There's a pit of acid here. Clearly, that's hiding the treasure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we have time for about one more. So
okay.
Yeah,
so
we've got 2 minutes.
When you're taking a published map from one of your products or someone else's, and you're wanting to translate it into a battle map, but the scale is like 1 square equals 15 feet, and your table is only about 4 foot by 5 foot, how do you make this sense of it's a humongous space and still fit it all on your table?
Well, you can break that down into several maps that then you put out, like, okay, this is the section you're in right now, this is the section you're in right now, and that sort of thing. Or you can also have, like, a smaller scale version of the map that's on the table, so it's like, okay, you're in this section of this massive complex. You are here. You know, it can be fun, too, you can just, like, draw in little tiny dots. You are here. Like you're smaller than this, one of the squares on this map is your entire party, and that sort of thing.
For Skeletons of Scarwall in Crimson Throne, I drew out all of Scarwall on the cartography wrapping paper. What is that called?
Gaming paper.
And cut it out. So each time my players found a new room,
yeah,
I could drop that
down.
That's
something that I've done as well.
The
and you
whole
can if you can't find gaming paper, I mean, you can buy it online, but you can also go to Staples or Home or Office Depot and get like presentation pads that they put on an easel that have 1-inch grids, and that's just a whole pad where you can do one at a time, and the cutting out of each individual room means that you can, I mean, it can take forever, but there's something really cool about, you know, players building that map, and you can even tape them together, you know, when they add them so that they're not moving all over your table. But yeah, I've done that for Pathfinder Society scenarios, even on small scale, even when I don't need to. If it's like you're going into Dralkard Manor, this is the room you're in. There's all these doors. Oh, you go through that door. Here's the next one. And that's another way of not showing what the final spot is going to be, because until you've plopped that piece down, they don't know.
Thanks. I'm running Giant Slayer.
Yeah, Giant Slayer is...
Spoiler, it's got big rooms.
Yeah.
Can't imagine why.
Yeah.
All right, well, that pretty much finishes us out. We have to wrap up for the next group coming in. So thank you all for coming.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction Podcast PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage, made possible with the help of Justin Sluder and Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad. To find more great Pathfinder audio, go to NoDirectionPodcast.com.